I want to spend the next little while finishing the tick up because I think it's important that we see what contributed. There are about 40 or 42 different things that happen, that are pertinent, that happen in the tick up or the peri-emergence, to give it its right name, in the peri-emergence that have affected deeply what emergence Christianity is. I don't think we can look at all of them, obviously. It would be a colossal bore. But I think we need to look at those which have most seriously and obviously affected and are affecting what emergence Christianity is. But if there's something now, we can interrupt. The groundwork is laid, and I've got through all that tenuous stuff about definitions and all of that that I was concerned about. Now I'm entirely interruptible if somebody wants to interrupt or just gets bored and wants to tell a joke or whatever happens.
Don't say open that door.
don't
open that door. No.
Okay, all right. If it's anything like your steering committee's, your subcommittee's report, I want it to happen. That's better than anything I ever said. I loved it. I just loved it. Okay, what I do want to do is look at those that I think we cannot avoid. And I did the flipper and talked about women. I did this part of the domestic evil. And I want to, while I'm on that particular part of building this thing, I want to go to 63. No, I don't. I want to go to 1940. Let me begin there. 1941 to 45. Let's start there. 41, of course, is the year Pearl Harbor, as you know. And as again, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. I'm just asking you to look at it in a different way. When Pearl Harbor happened, it was because Japan, we had been too lazy, good American style, to disestablish and mothball our materials of war and had sent them to Japan to be trashed and redone and reconfigured, and they were pleased to reconfigure it and return them to us on Pearl Harbor Day in 41. And when it happened, we had, of course, absolutely nothing to fight the war with. And I can remember 41 well enough to remember that we had nothing. There were no guns, there were no tanks. Most of you are too young to remember that, but I can remember the horror of that and my father's great concern that there was nothing to fight with, except we had men. And we called them Johnny. We called him Johnny or them Johnnies, whatever. And we conscripted them. But they had nothing to fight with. And so we did the inevitable thing. We took their women and made them. First, she was Wendy the welder. And then she became Rosie the riveter. I think Wendy's ever so much nicer, but Rosie's more masculine or something. I don't know. She became Rosie the riveter. And she went to work. She went to work simply because the only way she was going to get Johnny back was to give Johnny something to fight with. Otherwise, he would never be back. It was clear we were going to lose the war if we couldn't get some tanks and some airplanes and some guns over there and functioning. So she did. She went to work. She took the 2.5 children down the street to Grandma's house, and Grandma hated that war for obvious reasons, but she did her bit. Why does it matter? It matters for several reasons. The first of them is that I had a head of Department of Women's Studies in a major university say it took 16 months. How in the world she knows it's 16 months, I don't know, but she's very sure that 16 months from the time the first Rosie really went to work until Rosie whoever said, you know, at the end of 10 hours, I'm really, really tired. I truly, 10 hours in the factory is tough. I'm weary, and I can remember, I'm much too weary to go home to those children. And I can remember when Johnny was working this job, and when he was too tired, he would sometimes stop by the pub, and he would have one with the boys, and then he would come home. And Rosie started within 16 months, thanks to my head of women's studies department, within 16 months, Rosie is going by the pub also, or a lot of Rosies are. Does this mean that Rosie became a drunk? No. I'm sure some of them did, obviously, but very, very few. It means, and it's hugely significant, it means for the first time, women in Western culture found what Ray Olenberg calls a third good place. That is to say, they found a place in which they could gather for non-domestic issues. They could have a conversation in a public place about what a piss poor job the superintendent is doing, about how awful it is that they're not supplies, about the condition of the ladies' washroom, about any number of things, the state of the war, it didn't matter. They could have a non-domestic conversation and social life. it's going to affect the rest of American history in a very substantial way. We're less conscious of it now because we've lived through it and come to accept it. But now they don't have to have people over or have quilting bees or something like that. They can go to a bar and do it. Now, it's not going to last forever. We're going to have an interruption to it. But it's the third good place. And the theory of the third good place, Uhlenberg's theory, is hugely important in religion, as we will see in a minute. In addition, for the first time, Rosie has money that doesn't have to be taken through family council or specifically through Johnny for its disbursement. Now, she needed that money. We paid even corporals in the Second World War $24 a month. Nobody could support a family on that. You just couldn't take care of those two children. Had Rosie not worked, she'd have had to have gone to work for more reasons than just getting Johnny home. There was just not enough money to live on. So it was not that she was affluent, but it is to say that if there is a stereotype named Rosie, and we can stereotype it and speak generally, she didn't have to have Johnny telling her what to do with the money. Now, the bills told her what to do with the money, by and large, but she could still govern a little bit of it. And if you read the diaries and some of the records in Women's Studies Department, you see that one of the dear things about Rosie's life during those 4 years in which she was working was that by scrimping and being careful, she could sometimes get a little bit of money. Pin money was what, that's where pin money comes from. She could get a little money put back, and maybe it was just to buy a toy for a kid who truly, truly wanted it, and they couldn't afford it. And what joy it was to be able to put back enough and buy that toy. Or maybe it was just a lipstick that otherwise she couldn't have had. But she had governance of it. She had the control of it without any oversight, and it didn't go through family council. And I mean it. This is not a feminist statement. This isn't asking you to look at it purely as sociology. So that Rosie did those things, and she threw those rivets, and she did her job. She did it brilliantly, and she did it well. And because she did, Johnny came home again. And the minute Johnny came home again, she went back to being Mrs. Johnny. It's the first thing we have to understand. Now she was back to being Mrs. Johnny, but we called her June Cleaver. Those of you who remember June and Ward Cleaver, you may not, but we called her June Cleaver. Now what's happened while June or Rosie or whoever was on the factory production line is that technology has come along. In 41, when she went to work, or the first of 42, when she went to work, a lot of Rosies were still chopping wood. They really were, to cook on the cook stove. A lot of them were still boiling water. A lot of them were still washing clothes by hand in tubs. I can remember as a bride in 55, I still washed in a tub and hated every minute of it, but I remember doing it. By the time the war is over, technology has come. There are electric mixers, there are electric stoves, there are electric hot water heaters, there are electric laundry. What in the world is Rosie supposed to do with herself? You know, now she's accustomed to being away from home 10 hours. Now there's nothing to do. Plus which the things she used to do have all gone away. And so, you know, she can run a house with one-tenth of herself. What's supposed to happen to her? Well, the first thing she does is she looks for the third good place, and Johnny says no to the bar for very good reasons. That's male territory still in Johnny's mind. And so she goes to the only other possibility. She goes to the church. And when you look at the figures and you hear the golden age of American Protestantism, don't believe it. That's the golden age of Rosie. That's the golden age of Rosie turning it into a social club. It's where, and that's not to say that there was not some religious feeling about it. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that when you build a bigger basketball court than you've got a nave or a sanctuary, it ought to tell you something. When a mainline Methodist church has to have a bowling alley and has a capital campaign to fund a bowling alley or a swimming pool, it ought to tell you something. You know, those aren't what you call really essential, but they do build huge numbers. And in addition, Johnny was playing Ward Cleaver. He was going because that was where you were supposed to go to make business contact. That does not say some of them weren't faithful Christians. It is to say that probably the majority of them were Christianized vis-a-vis Christians, that if you actually looked at those roles, they are inflated. The golden age of Protestantism should be looked at really with suspicion. And you can see that as that impetus to do those things falls off, so the figures begin to fall off. And what we're losing in that first decline of figures is the June and Ward Clippers, who were there for social reasons or sociological reasons or reasons of just plain occupying themselves and of trying to find a balance again about where to integrate with society post-war. But the thing about June and Ward was that they didn't have any little girls. They had Beaver and what was the other one?
Wally.
Yeah. They had no girls. If they'd had girls, it would have been called Betty for Dan what's her name?
Gloria Stein.
Gloria Stein. That would have been the name of the girls. And the girls... The girls were that first generation after Johnny Comes Home Again. They were 6 and 7 and 8, and they could remember the years before Daddy came home. They could remember well that there were times when Mama had some control over money, when you could sometimes get something from Mama without having to ask. They remembered the years when Mama whistled sometimes, and now she can't because that's not ladylike. They can remember when Mama even sang sometimes, and she doesn't sing much anymore. And in all seriousness, if you read what they wrote, they could remember times when the angry noises after Lights Out, the angry voices didn't go on. And it was a more peaceful time. And they said, not on my watch, which is exactly what Fredan said, not on my watch. It's not going to happen to me. I'm going to go get a college education. It's aggravated by the fact that the GI Bill of Rights, for the first time, American women, and there were many women in the World War, Second World War, they were WACs, they were WAVES, they were government secretaries, they were whatever you want to call them, but they too fell under the provisions of the GI Bill. So they became the first wave of women who were educated all the way up through the college degree. They were followed by Rosie and Johnny's girl children who got it. And they pushed and pushed and pushed and said, we will have an equal playing field. Betty Friedan and Gloria, I will be just as employable as my daddy. I will be just as employable as my husband. I will not be dependent ever again. In that way, I will not be an economic slave. Now, they are reacting, and like most reactions, they overreacted. There's no question of that, because you can look and you can see the divorce rates suddenly begin to climb like this, because now women are free to go. It is aggravated by 63, which I still think really is maybe the most significant. 63 is the year that the birth control pill comes on the market. Now, we've always known how to control. The woman with 7 children says we've always known how to control fertility. But by and large, I wanted them. Isn't that scary? I can't think now why, but I at the time wanted them for some reason.
Yeah. A good Catholic.
That's right. And Sam says, the time we figured out what was causing it, we were addicted. Whatever. But we've known. French letters is, the common joke about how you control fertility. We didn't like the methods, but we could do it. And we could control it. When the birth control comes along, Ben, it's not because it controls fertility. It's because up until 63, there is an uneven playing field. And it's biologically based. And I didn't want to do this before lunch because I want people to stay with me afterwards long enough to not be totally offended. And it really is not an attempt to offend. It's just to ask you to look at it for what it was. There was an uneven playing field prior to 1963. And that uneven playing field was due to purely physical reasons. Once a month, for about a week, a woman at that time would have a period in which she felt less than socially acceptable or at her best, when she was intellectually, in all honesty, a little bit foggy probably, and when she was emotionally laid-by. There's no question about that. Now, my feminist aside is to say I have never for the life of me understood why it was that it is worse to be mad as hell 1 week out of the month instead of 31 days out of the month the way a man does, but that's a different issue. You see, nonetheless, it was just like I've never understood why we wanted to give up being superior in order to be equal, but that wasn't the problem. It makes no sense to me. But so be it, I play by an old set of rules and I got farther, sweetheart. But anyway, it happened. So we have the problem. When the birth control pill comes out, It's very, it's within 6 months, and this one is certified by more heads of women's studies and more. Within 6 months, the women begin to say, ah, the board of directors is coming into town on Tuesday. Mrs. Murphy, that's a euphemism, gentlemen. Mrs. Murphy is supposed to arrive on Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday. I can't afford to be at less than my best. All I have to do is borrow 3 or 4 of those pink pills from next month, and then fudge next month, or else tell the doctor I dropped them down the John or something and get a different prescription. What you found was women beginning almost immediately to control the time of the menses by using the pills. It wasn't that they used them for birth control. It really was that they used them for the control of the menstrual period. Now the ceiling, now it becomes an equal playing field to some extent, or it's on its way to becoming an even playing field. Now, when that happens, then you begin to really see the increase in the divorce rate. Yes, there's no question about that. Now you begin to see what we have now, women who sometimes make more than the husband. Or you certainly saw two-income families where the families stayed together. In addition to the freedom to break up and to destroy the home, and essentially, like it or not, the introduction of divorce and our ability to accept it, empowered by economic factors with the coming of the birth control pill, made a major blow to the traditional Reformation-based nuclear family. It just did, because women didn't have to stick. They didn't have to take it. And they could leave whether just because they didn't like the color of his hair anymore. I mean, it got to be silly, and we all know that. We all know that the home begins to change here. Also, for the first time in Western history, probably the first time in human history, the traditional home, the one we had had up until then, was that Johnny, whoever he was, and in whatever stage of Western history he lived, went out to conquer the world for the sake of the home. Whatever it was he did, he went out to do this, and he brought the booty home. If he were a caveman, he went out and knocked animals in the head and dragged the carcass home. You know, if he were an entrepreneur, he went out and knocked Wall Street in the head and dragged home the certificates of deposit or whatever. But it was always this. Now you've got an equal playing field, and Rosie is going out to conquer the world, and Johnny is going out to conquer the world, and the 2.5 kids that have been in daycare all day are going out because there's nowhere else to go. And what you've got is two people now who are conquering the world for the sake of conquering the world. It's not for the sake of the home. It's not that they're bringing it back to the home. It's that they come back at night to the home half dead, and they use the home not as the thing which they are nurturing, but as that which nurtures them. You come home to get rest. You come home in order to be revived. You bring the kids home to revive them. The home now becomes a thing you use instead of the thing you're making. It no longer becomes the focus. Think about it. And this is the beginning of the biblically illiterate, because once again, generations, because once again, when that happened, when that subtle shift, and it took about 10 years before you could really see it was sort of universally in play. And it's only been in about the last 15 years that it's absolutely in play. And what you get is the fact that we're all half dead. The two adult parents are dead from being at work all day and high tension jobs, most of them. The kids are worn out from school and then daycare afterwards. And so everybody comes home to take out from McDonald's, or if you're lucky, from Domino's Pizza. And you sit around and eat it. And yes, Christian parents hear prayers sometimes, but that's it. There is a minuscule family altar very shortly thereafter. Everybody's too tired. Kids are too tired to hear it. Parents are too tired to give it. And so we go through the routine, but we don't have the real altar. We don't have the transmission of the faith that we had prior to this, and that matters enormously. Because the great, with the exception of the Presbyterians, who somehow got it, I don't know why, but other branches of Christianity, including Catholicism and Orthodoxy, failed to understand that the home was no longer transmitting the faith. And it's not just that everybody's dead, and here really is one of the reasons feminists hate me. But the honest truth is, and you know it and I know it, that when Mama was home, by whatever name, Rosie or whatever, when Mama was home, when the school bus burped the kids out, and she was in the kitchen, and maybe she was peeling the potatoes or snapping the beans, who knows, for supper, and it would be a supper that she would cook, and it wouldn't be carry-on. When the kids came home, there was always some conversation. There was conversation about how school go, there was a little treat maybe, cook, whatever. But also, Mama was, without even meaning to, constantly transmitting the faith, you know? Johnny comes in from second grade and he says, "Wait, Peter used the daddy word, a bad word today, one of daddy's bad words." "Well, what was it?" "Well, they said he should never say it again, but it's ass." And Mama says, "Ass. Did you know ass is in the Bible? Did I ever tell you about Balaam's ass? It's a really good story." And she's off and running. Now, the kid loves it because she is just defused, you know, and given him permission to use an ugly word. Or she's looking out the kitchen window and she sees, you know, and she says to the little girl, "Oh, look over on the hills, how lovely it is. Did I ever tell you the story of Jephthah's daughter who danced across the hills for 30 days to mourn her virginity?" And they're off and running. Not because Mama is transmitting the faith or being Sunday school teacher. It's because in the natural course of the afternoon as it winds down, she's transmitting it all day long, just like this. When that goes away, so does biblical literacy, which is why we can say in this country we're 2.5 generations into biblical illiteracy. And it's hugely important. It's hugely important. Not to make too big a deal of it, but it is. Now, I spoke of Martin Marty and his 1969, and I want to jump there just for a minute because I brought it up before. As you will remember from American history, the last half of the last quarter of the 19th century was spent building railroads, and it was built by the railroad barons with slave labor. Essentially, it was Chinese labor. It was Asian labor. Imported under false pretenses and absolutely as slave. It was serfdom at best, kindest word you can put on it. But the result of being able to hire that labor at so small a price was that the American workman was squeezed out of the deal. And so by 1879, you get our unions, or the beginning of our unions, our first conglomerates of workers, petitioning the Congress to fix legislation so that Chinese were seriously restricted. Those of Asian origin were seriously restricted. And that fight continued right up until 1921, when the law was passed that said that nobody of Asian extraction could come into this country anymore. We continued to persecute them right up through Second World War, but by 21, they could not come. They absolutely were forbidden if you were of Asian extraction. When the wars came along in the mid-century, we fought three of them with an Oriental theater, with a theater in either Vietnam or Korea or Japan itself. And human nature being what human nature is, our guys, and later our guys and girls, fell in love with Asians and married them and wanted to bring them home, wanted to have Asian American children and Asian American families. That was forbidden by law. It couldn't happen. In 69, the law was finally changed under pressure from mostly servicemen and servicewomen who had Asian mates and half-Asian children who pressured Congress, and the law was changed. Why does it matter? It matters because in this country, American religion, and especially rural, and remember we are really urbanizing after the Second World War. The bulk of urbanization happens after the Second World War. In rural America, which is where most of us live, there was generic Protestantism was the dominant religion. I can remember my father laughing that on first Sunday, the Methodist preacher, always the circuit rider, came. Second Sunday, it was the Baptist preacher. Third Sunday, it was the Presbyterian from the town over. And fourth Sunday, I can't remember who it was, but fifth Sunday, if there were a fifth Sunday, Grandpa had to preach because they'd run out of preachers. And so it was a kind of generic thing. It was also very rural. And in rural schedules and rural life, there's almost no time for a spiritual life. Say what you want to. The truth of it is that if you're up at dawn in order to get ready to go in the fields, and you are in the fields all day, and you come back at dusk, half dead, to milk the cow, feed the stock, and try to feed the kids, and you fall into bed. And if you get more than the Our Father who art, you're a genius. That's a real devout Christian way of living. And so there was no spirituality. As the urbanization, except in the Roman Church and to some extent in the Anglican, but as urbanization continued, we found more and more people not living the rural life, not living the physically demanding life of the rural country. And they developed the most dangerous of all things, free time. free time when there wasn't something physical that had to happen. And their minds came out to play. And whatever you can say about Protestantism, you have to admit it has no sex appeal at all. No bells and whistles, no, you know, none of that. It's not there. And so we begin to get, from 1958 on, you begin to get things like Hazleton and Est and all of those New Age things. You begin to see that's urbanizing America, trying to figure out where it is, what do you do with the internal life. And Martin Marty says, in 69, when that happened, the floodgates were opened. And here came thousands and thousands of Asians. May I sidebar by saying, thank God. If you've looked at SATs lately, you know that one of the smartest things that dominant America ever did was open that door to the genius of the Asian people and to what they're bringing into our common culture. But when it came in, the significant thing for religion is they brought with them hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Not all of them were Buddhist, but they all brought hundreds and hundreds of years of experience with the spiritual or the subjective life. With the, they had a rhetoric, they had a vocabulary for talking about it. And much of the spiritual and not religious found its release, if you will, in the coming of Buddhism. And you can trace it from 69 right on to the turn of the millennium. Remember the angels that happened in the early, in the first of the 90s? All those bestseller books. Remember that everybody you knew turned Celtic. Celtic was the move to, because that was the only indigenous spirituality we could find. If we weren't going to be Buddhist, then we might be Celtic. Everything green sold, even if it were lousy, if it were printed in green ink or had a green cover, it was going to sell there for a while. That was when St. Augustine became the poster boy of Christianity for a while. I've never figured out the connection, but it did. It's because they opened the door to it. And then you've got this influx of centering prayer, with all due respect to Father Keating and Father Pill, Basil Pillman, it was not an ancient tradition, and you know that, I hope, anyway. It was not an ancient, wonderful tradition, and I've heard Thomas Keating say it was an attempt to take what had been in early church and modify it in order to counter this. To keep Christians within the Christian tradition. That's not to say considering prayer isn't a good thing. I didn't say that. I just said that it was not, centering prayer as we know it, didn't exist in the 3rd century. It only existed when Basil Pennington and Thomas Keating had to respond. In some the same way, the Labyrinth and Lauren Arthurs didn't invent the Labyrinth, obviously it had been there, but brought it back into play in an attempt to find some kind of spirituality that was indeed Christian. And we were getting funny things. You ever hear of Jubus? You talked about Jubus. Jubus are what Jews call their fellow Jews who are practicing Buddhism. And they laugh about the Jubus. And there were all kinds of books, bestsellers. Sylvia Borstein wrote 2 or 3 and made a small fortune on how to be a good Jew within the Buddhist tradition. Or how to be a Buddhist under Torah. And that kind of thing. I, in 64, received, when I was with Publishers Weekly, one of our jobs was to look at manuscripts that people weren't sure they wanted to publish, and we would get them from time to time from major houses. And I got one from a major house from an editor whom I liked very much, who said, I'm not sure about this. And this is 94. I'm not, and I wish I had kept it. But the working title of the manuscript was, How to Be a Buddhist, a Jewish Buddhist with Christocentric proclivities. And I said, I don't think it's going to work. I wish I had kept the title page. But we were to that kind of attempt, we were that starved for it. And you can see Taze rushing into this. And one of the things about emergence Christianity is it rushes into this. It wants the spiritual life, and it's less interested in Buddhism than was the generation just before it. That is, Buddhism is not a satisfactory explanation for emergence Christians. They want spirituality. It's real for them. The other one that Professor Marty and I both share an interest in is 1935, 37, or 39, according to which year you want. 35 is the year that Bill Wilson gave up and said, I'm a drunk, and I've got to have help. and he worked with evangelical Christians briefly and became convinced that Christianity or something superimposed on Christianity could indeed work. 37 is the year in which AA is incorporated, and 39 is the year when the big book is published for the first time. Why does it matter? It matters because for the first time, somebody actually says, you know, pastors are wonderful. That's great. Fine. But when you're afflicted with something awful, when you're addicted, you are better healed by those who are equally addicted and have beat it than you are by any pastor in the world. Now, this country was not exactly fond of pastors to start with. We were always anti-clerical. You don't go 2,000 miles on a wooden tub because you like things at home. You just don't. So it's not that we were in love with pastors necessarily, but we deeply respected them. The first major blow to the pastoral role of privilege happens with AA, not because Wilson wanted it to happen, but because it was a byproduct of what he did. You are better healed by those who are equally addicted than you are by a non-sufferer. Don't go to the pastor, come to AA, was the message that was heard. And heard correctly because he was right, because it did work. It is also the beginning of the small group movement. Ooh, don't let Methodists rise up and hit me. The small group within the emergence experience. Yes, the small group had worked for Methodism, no question about it. But it had also fallen out of use. When Wilson employs it, it becomes now a much more vibrant thing. Thirdly, it is a clear definition of non-nuclear family. It is the bonding of people outside of marriage or bloodlines into a unit that is more significant for many of them than is the bloodline connection or than is the marriage bond. It's that. Fourthly, and perhaps in many ways most important, it's the first time that an accepted form of human agency can honestly say it doesn't matter what you worship, just as long as you worship something. It's the beginning of generic God. And one of the great ironies is how, and I know this is a confusion of symbols, but yeah, you know, one of the great ironies is that the church welcomed AA and began to house them. You know, almost every church in this country now has somewhere in its basement an AA meeting. Which is ironic in many ways. It's not that they're mutually exclusive. It's that it is a little like taking the asp to your breast in some ways. You want it to happen. You believe in the program. But it nonetheless is part of the reason we need a theology of religion right now. It is the fact that it taught and it got away with it. Then the fifth thing is, and it's part of what I just said about Buddhism, the fifth thing is, that once you get that big book out there in 39, and you can watch it, once you get that out, you begin to introduce the question, what is good psychology and good mental health, and what is religion, and what is non-labeled or generic spirituality? And I just said something really significant, whether anybody can hear it over all that good lunch or not, that now we've opened the question of what is good. Where is the line between good religion? Where is the line between Joel Osteen and Jesus Christ, if you want to put it that way? Exactly. It beats me. I can't answer the question. You get from that. Hazel, when the big book goes on sale in commercial bookstores, in 1959, it goes on sale. And I've had merchant after merchant say to me, you know, it was amazing. Religion always stayed in the back, they used to call it the back unlit left-hand corner, which was where religion always was in bookstores. And we put it back there, and then all of a sudden, everybody started going back there. And merchant after merchant would say, they weren't drunks. They weren't drunks at all. They just wanted the information that was in there about how to live the good life, how it is that you can live. And so, in many ways, psychology, applied psychology, begins to take over much of the role that belonged traditionally to Christianity or to whatever form of faith, but primarily to Christianity. And you do get Est, and you do get Hazleton, and you do get the self-help movement. until you arrive at a place when, again, I was at Publishers Weekly, and we used to read, they would bring in forthcoming books in what's called galleys by the car, by the truckload. And they would bring them into the office, and some poor intern would sort of separate them out according to whether they were going to religion editor or to fiction editor or whatever. And then the self-help editor and I would sit on the floor with the cart that had been delivered to us that day and try to decide whether it was religion or psychology or self-help. Who reviewed this book? You know, was it mine, was it hers, or was it his? And very often it got down to, does it say Jesus? Then I get it. If it doesn't say Jesus, it probably belongs somewhere else. And what happens is the mega church is born here. Mega church is a label that speaks to the quantity and not to the necessarily to the definition of the content. Mega church, there are mega emergence churches. There are mega everything churches. But by and large, the traditionally defined mega church that is sort of long on good principles of the good life and sort of shy on theology, and it will always attract more people than will the real stuff. This kind of religion doesn't cost you much. Part of the reaction of the emergence right now is, and when you get my age, you do a lot of endowed lectures because they don't know what else to do with you. And when you do endowed lectures, you have a lot of conversation with kids. And if I hear one more kid say to me, you know, I don't want a religion that doesn't cost me something, over and over, it's like a mantra. Or, if religion is so important, how come my daddy never says anything about him at supper? An awareness that indeed what we have lost, what we have developed, is Christianized as opposed to Christian. And part of the separation is to become practicing, or again, radically obedient Christians as opposed to Christianized. Are you with me? Do you know what I'm saying? Because it really matters. It really matters. This is not to say I took a shot at Mr. Osteen, and someday he's got every right to complain, probably. I'm not in the business of one Christian taking a shot at another. But I can honestly say that once, for professional reasons, I spent 47 minutes on a Sunday morning in a hotel room listening to Mr. Osteen because I knew it was time for me to do so. And never once in the 47 minutes did I hear the name Jesus Christ at all. It just wasn't necessary to the message. But not only was I listening, but some 17,500 folk were in the same stadium listening to him at the same time. Is that wrong? No, I don't think he's doing huge damage. But it is a difference between being an observant Christian and being Christianized. Or to put it in Jewish terms, and Judaism has made this distinction for several centuries now, the difference between being a cultural Jew and an observant Jew, or an ethnic Jew and an observant Jew. And that separation, you can trace from this, that separation has increased in this country enormously. About 5 years ago, and I need to go look up the specifics, but roughly I'm right, and the thrust of the story is correct. About 6 years ago, Alan Wolf, who is a sociologist on faculty at Columbia University, in conjunction with the New York Times, did a study of American religion, trying to find out what the beliefs were, of what Americans really believe. And he did, it was 1,000 questions, and I've forgotten the size, I should know, but I don't remember, the size of the audience, but it was all over the country, and it was well done. He's a very credible and credentialed demographer, so there's no question about the scholarliness. And he found what you would expect, that 94% of us believe in some form of God. At that time, 83%, it's now dropped to 81, 83% of us believe in the Christian religion, or the Christian way of being. And that was all fun. And then he went down, and very near, somewhere in the 900s, was the question, do you believe in the virgin birth? Now, as you probably know, it's certainly in Anglicanism and in every other congregation, so far as I know, if you actually stand up in the chancel and say, those of you who believe in the historicity of the virgin birth get on this side, and those of you who don't believe it get on this side, you're going to have mass chaos in the center aisle. Because nobody is willing to say yay or nay. If you say you absolutely believe in it, people believe you're weird and a conservative and probably one of them. If you say you don't believe in it, then they are horrified with you and you're no longer a good person. And thus we don't get on that issue if we can help it. So what Wolf found was that 82% of us believe in the virgin birth. Now that's not possible. if 83% of us are Christian, and it's a highly divisive issue, it can't possibly be that 82% of us believe in the virgin birth. And so he went back doubting it and checked the answer. Each of the respondents checked the answer against whether you were Christian or not, whether you were Jewish or not, whether you were deist or not, and found that 60% of the non-deists, and I've forgotten the percentage of Jews and non-Christians, all believed in the virgin birth. They believed in the virgin birth because you can't have Christmas without it. See? That's Christianized. That's Christianized. That's what we're talking about. So that it comes up out of this progression of things. And it's hugely important to what Emergence is fighting against. Don't tell me you believe in the virgin birth unless you do. I don't care whether you do or not. Just don't tell me. And we will look at how they get around that conundrum sometime this afternoon, or before the second coming, I hope. We will get there. There is also, it's impossible to not speak, of course, of two things that happened in the 1930s. The first of which is the Holocaust. I can remember the Holocaust, and I can remember that there's nothing there to remember. That is to say, I was very much alive and aware, and we didn't know. My father's mother was of Jewish descent. It doesn't do me any good, simply because it has to go through the matriarchal line, and because it comes through the patriarchy, it doesn't do me any good. But nonetheless, had we known, I'm pretty sure it would have been talked about in our home. And it wasn't. We just didn't realize it was going on. But what happened, of course, was that the Jews who were most able, those who were most empowered, the brightest, the wealthiest, whatever, were the ones who got out. And from Kristallnacht on, you can see them fleeing into this country. We did not let them all in, but we let in a lot. And the result was they brought with them things we didn't know how to do. I can remember that in 1941, we had no idea. We couldn't even make good firecrackers. I can remember complaining that the firecrackers just didn't do what they were supposed to do, much less put a rocket over the English Channel and into Germany. And there was no way we were going to win that war if we could not somehow take England as a base and bombard the continent this way and break Hitler's back without losing all our men. We just didn't have enough to do it. There was no way to do it. The German Jews came in, and the Polish Jews, Eastern European Jews, came in and showed us how to do it. They showed us how to make the atom bomb. They showed us how to win that bloody war. They also showed us how to do all kinds of other things technologically that we didn't even know we wanted to do. Not the least of which was good television for the first time, fine movies for the first time. They went into the media, they went into the armed force, they won that war for us. And the result is that for the first time in history, a dominant culture has embraced Judaism with affection. The nearest it ever came before was Egypt, and if you will remember, Joseph couldn't eat with the Pharaoh. There was still a line. At Publishers Weekly, my immediate superior was a woman whom I admired greatly, child of the Holocaust, Daisy Merrillis. Parents escaped from Auschwitz, or they were released from Auschwitz before they themselves died. They married, and she was born in the DP camps and spent the first 3 years of her life in the DP camps before she came to this country. Brilliant woman, deeply observant Jew. And when she gets discouraged to this day, she will still say to me, "Tickle, tickle. The one thing Sinai did not prepare my people for was to be accepted." And she's absolutely right. And then she'll go on and say, "You're about to love us to death." And it's true. We are about to love them to death. The figures are alarming of the intermarriage and of the ability within those marriages to combine the services, that is, to put the two traditions together. And one of the results of the Holocaust, in 1989, Bishop Jack Spong, wrote a bestseller called Jesus, My Hebrew Lord. My father, who had a mother of Jewish descent, my father would have died if anybody had said to him before his death, "You know, Jesus was a Jew." He would have smacked me or washed my mouth out with soap or something. Absolutely could not be. Could not be. By 89, we're writing books about Jesus, our Hebrew Lord. It's the result of the Holocaust and a result of their coming here. And what's happening is, in Emergence Christianity, we are getting... unless I'm wrong, and I don't make a whole lot of predictions, but by 2050, we're going to be talking about ourselves as Judeo-Christians. Watch it. It's going to happen. Emergence will look you dead in the eye and say, don't you give me that crap, their term, don't you give me that crap about two books in one set of covers. It's one book, damn it.
Amen.
It's one, but yeah, and they will cuss, cuss more than I just did. Don't give me that. Don't give me that.
You go on with it.
You know, that's right. It's one. It's one. They want you to talk about the Witch of Endor. They want you to talk about Melchizedek. They want to know about Jephthah's daughter. And they're basically illiterate, biblically illiterate, and so it's all brand new and it's all wonderful, but it's one story. And if you lop it off at the Maccabees, as if it's two things. And most of us now read the Hebrew Bible instead of the Old Testament in our services. That's thanks to emergence pressure, whether we know it or not. Yeah. It's the Hebrew Bible. It's my Bible coming to me out of the Hebrew tradition before we got around to adding it. And it's a direct result of the Holocaust. The other thing that happens is that for instance, 1939, and I choose 39 because it was the year in which it happened to my husband's family. In 1939, if the baby got pneumonia, and you knew it was pneumonia, the first thing you did was you called the pastor. And you said, Pastor Kathy, which was my husband's baby sister's name, she was 5 years old, Kathy has got pneumonia. Would you pray for her, please? And would you call the ladies and start up the prayer chain? And on Wednesday night, would you have special prayers for Kathy? And everybody did. And we prayed. And when Kathy got to the point of crisis, is what they used to call it. Some of you will remember crisis. In pneumonia, it's a very obvious thing when the breath is harder and harder to draw. And then there comes that moment of absolute crisis when the baby goes and either breathes again and it's over for some reason, or doesn't breathe and death has come. But the pastor will be there during the crisis. And if she breathes again, he will lead in prayers of thanksgiving. If she doesn't, he will be there to console the family and begin to prepare for the funeral. By 1941, we had gantrosine and we were well on our way to penicillin. And when my infant sister-in-law, 5-year-old sister-in-law, died, she did not make it in 39 of pneumonia. But by 41 and 42, we had the drugs. And if Kathy got pneumonia, you went bopping down the street, did Daddy, to the pharmacy. And if he happened to pass the pastor on the way on the street, he would say, Kathy's got pneumonia. I wish you kind of shoot one up to heaven for us, please. It's going to be tough for the next few days. And he picked up the penicillin, and then he went back home, and that was the end of that, except maybe that she was listed in the bulletin as needing prayers on Sunday. But it was no big deal, and nobody thought God did a thing about it. It was the penicillin, don't you know? Big difference. Big difference in pastoral role. Big difference in human vulnerability. Huge difference in understanding what healing is about. And the emergence, if it's about nothing else, is about picking up that Pentecostal, picking up Azusa Street, and seeing what it is that happens. What is the nature of healing? What is the role of God in healing? What is the efficacy of prayer? Does Jesus indeed mean that if you say to that mountain, get up and go into the sea and believe it, it will? And a good emergence Christian will say, damn right. So why aren't you moving them? It's a big part. When technology came along, and I meant it last night, the word resuscitation never occurred in exegesis until about 100 years ago when we suddenly began to talk about resuscitation. We became almost too smart for our own good, and it happened then. Now, where is my... Here is my marker. This can go on, obviously, a little bit of forever, I suppose. Somewhere in here, I want to do 1980 or thereabouts. I cannot remember, and I ought to look it up. I think it's near 1975, somewhere along here. When Sony Walkmans come along, do you remember Sony Walkmans, that antique thing? Sony Walkman comes along, and all of a sudden, you've got these kids going down the street with things in their ears and thing around their neck, and they're giving it this. They're, walking into lampposts, they're so with it, like this, And why does it matter? It matters because it's the beginning of populist music. It's not the same as populist music. It matters because before the Walkman came along, if you wanted to hear good music and you were just an average Joe of average income, you had to go to church. Church, and even if it was Miss Susie banging it out tunelessly on the piano, at least it was music. And you sat there and you listened to her. Usually, if you were urbanized, it was in a cathedral, and it was a good organ, and it was a paid organist, and it was worth hearing. That's where the music was. Sony comes along and it does two things. It means you don't have to go to church to hear music. And even more important, it becomes participatory. As the kid walks into the lamppost, he's given it full body. You cannot give full body to Bach. I'm sorry. When you're sitting on one of those pews, watching it be performed, it's an entirely different thing from participatory. And one of the characteristics of emergence, as we saw so beautifully last night, that was very close to an Anglo-Emergent service last night. I would have called it Anglo-Emergent if I had been diagnosing it, was we were participating. When Emergence Christianity talks about incarnation, it's not talking about Jesus, about God becoming human. I mean, that's fine. That's a subsection of incarnation. What it's talking about is all of religion functioning in my body. What it's talking about is I've got to feel it in my body. I want a service in which I can dance. I hear you had that this morning. I want a service in which I can paint if I feel inclined to express what I'm feeling that way. Or I can sculpt if that's what I'm feeling. Or I can sing. I want the music to be something that's a part of me. I don't want it performed for me. I want to feel it. I want it to be me and my body celebrating God. That's what incarnation means. And the Walkman opens that door up wide open, and it changed. And one of the great mistakes of the so-called mainline denominations, if anybody knows what they are, I'm never quite sure, but assuming you know what that term means, one of their problems, one of the things they have most foolishly done, is to fail to understand the difference between performed music and participatory music. And I know I'm carrying coals to Newcastle when I say that here, but it's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. You cannot ask performance music to do the same thing. You can't ask for it to be the whole thing, and the church failed to realize that. Along in here, somewhere in the 1950s, we had a man named Alan Turing. Ever heard of Alan Turing? Of course, the Turing machine. Turing is the father of the computer, and it is he who began the binary system 010101 as a way of computation. I can remember in the 1950s as an undergraduate working with an IBM. We thought, Lord, we thought it was wonderful. The university bought one. It would have filled over half of this room anyway. It was incredible. Prior to the coming of that IBM, which was God's gift to us, we were working on the really modern principle of sticking the spindles through holes punched in cards. Yes, the older ones of you remember what. Yeah, and it was wonderful. You know, you could handpick all of the class of 91 because they had a dot on their cards. And the cards were all the same. Bill doesn't know what I'm talking about. And you took a long needle and all of the cards that came up through that hole out of the stack, that was your class in 91, you know, and it was it was God's gift. And then we got the IBM, which couldn't do much more, to tell you the truth, for all of its puffing and puffing. And from there on, from the time the Turing machine comes, then we get right up to what we've got right now. And the computer matters for a whole lot of reasons. And obviously, first of all, and I always get shaky, I'm going to give you a break after this one, because this one also tends to offend, are too upset. The computer opens up, obviously computation, it opens up a number of questions. First of all, it spreads information. And when, not only does it speed up our research and that kind of thing, but it spreads pure information. When the World Wide Web came along in the early 90s, then the floodgates really blew open. Then we could contact each other. And then when the search engines of Google came along, it was fantastic. And anybody who tries to write a learned paper without Wikipedia must not understand the question. Because for all of its lousy scholarship, it does tend to point you in the right direction. And the notion of having to go back through all of those stacks and microfiche and all that stuff when I was doing a thing, good Lord, I would shoot myself now, or go undecorated and show up without a hood, before I would go through all of that. Again, now that I know it's so easy. But what it does also is open up the question, and it seems spurious or silly at first, open up the question of thinking. Can the computer think? Does it think? And it led to cognitive science. Cognitive science, as you'll see on your list of terms, is a very new field. It comes after the working with the computer. It comes after the computer is a big part of the conversation that you really get cognitive science. And you really begin to get the questions about what is the nature of thinking. It's going to lead right to the question of what does it mean to be human. At the same time that the computer was coming along, so was the drug wars. And the drug scene in the 60s was an awful thing. Now, nobody's saying it's not. But every knife cuts two ways. And one of the things it did was it showed us that if I give you the same amount of the same drug at the same time every day, and you've eaten the same thing and drunk the same thing and had the same amount of rest, I can change you predictably and reproducibly, that's the key to it, reproducibly, from person A to person B. Okay? That leads within 6 seconds to the question, which one am I? Am I the result of a chemical mix? And the answer is yes, you are. Like it or not. When Prozac came out in 92, it spawned a lot of books. Remember Prozac Nation or listening to Prozac in 93, 94, and 95? And because I was still with the book industry, I had to do a lot of traveling the country talking about those books. And I never one time spoke about Prozac that I didn't get at least 3 or 4 people afterwards. Always 2 or 3 of them in the ladies' room, but always under the stairwell. I never could figure out, in huge auditoriums, you've got the open stairwell kind of thing. There's this L under it. I always got backed into there. I couldn't quite figure out who would come up and say to me one of two things. I am clinically depressed, and that drug has made all the difference in the world. But I quit it. And I would say, why? I quit it because if God had meant for me to be that person, he would have made me that way. And the other one was, and this one used to just make me shriekingly angry. It doesn't anymore, but it used to. The other one was, I'm clinically depressed, and that drug made all the difference in the world, but I don't take it anymore. And I would say, why? And the answer would be, my pastor told me that if God had meant me to feel that good, he would have made me that way, which is just, malpractice. Lord have mercy.
Them
Lord,
boys need killing.
Them boys need whooping upside the head anyway, Go get a crocodile and slap them with one. Absolutely. Wrestling an alligator on that one. But it happens so consistently. Why? Because sola scriptura, and because the old way of doing it just did not admit that there could be any number of people in there according to the chemistry going in. It was made worse when Garry Kasparov, remember when Big Blue beat the Russian champ at chess? Remember that? Mm-hmm. There was consternation all over the church. What? You mean that a machine built beat a human champion? That we can build something that can outmaneuver? Well, the answer is yes, because it does it more quickly. It answers or it can process the processes more quickly than can the human brain. And I just said something significant. It won because it can process the processes more quickly than we can. In May of last year, Roadrunner, which is Roadrunner, which is a joint thing between National Science Foundation and IBM, went through the petaflap for the first time. The petaflap means that Roadrunner completed successfully over a quadrillion. I have no idea what a quadrillion is, but completed over a quadrillion successful and accurate maneuvers in 1 second. What that means is we haven't got a prayer. We'll never do that. Our brains are not going to ever do that. They're just not going to do it. They're incapable of it. I was so interested that the first issue of June for Newsweek gave 5 pages to a man named Kurzweil, Ray Kurzweil. It'll be read by the people in your congregation. You need to know who Ray Kurzweil is. Ray Kurzweil has said, the Kurzweil organ thing, electronic, it's one of his. Kurzweil is a, oh yeah, man is a genius who every once in a while turns out to be wrong, but he's usually right. He has said for 20 years now that the cyborg is coming. The cyborg is what happens when we implant machines or computers or whatever you want to call them into our bodies in order to take advantage of their ability to go through the pediflap when we can't. The cyborg will be increasingly more machine than human. And he's probably right. Somebody in this room probably has a pacemaker. It works on a computer. Everybody in this room, if I say to you very quickly, you know, multiply 49 times 62, what do you get? You'll whip out the cell phone or the computer. Your granddaddy could have answered that question. We have already begun to download to the machine. Now, am I trying to be spectacular or make some sort of scene? No. I'm telling you that part of not understanding what a human being is that we no longer know, increasingly we don't know, where the line is. Obviously, it's no longer our intellectual ability that makes us human. And obviously, we cannot outthink the machine. Can the machine initiate? There's a thing called the China Brain Project, which, well, let's go ahead. Oxford University, which has been very concerned with their, I don't know how to say it, the size of concern right now by credentialed academics, people who are not trying to show off or to speak beyond that which they know, who are not trying to startle you, in other words, the amount of academic credibility and resources that are going into cognitive science is overwhelming right now. Nick Bostrom heads the Institute of the Future for at Oxford University, and he's deeply involved in this. And it is very sure Kurzweil is right, that we will indeed have what's called the singularity, another Kurzweilian term. The singularity is where we are one, where the machine and we are one and the same. And where we incorporate each other. The other possibility is that the machine will take on human characteristics. And up until about 5 years ago, I'm not trying to frighten you, but please just hear me. Up until about 5 years ago, the argument was that the machine could never initiate, nor could the machine ever feel emotion. The China Brain Project, which is now in its end of its first year and its second year, is built on two little old PCs, normal ones, that have been programmed at such a level that they are now beginning to spontaneously develop emotions that are analogous to human emotions. When that happens, then we're very close to the age of the singularity. What does that mean? It means right back where we were this morning. If you're in the business of saving souls or ministering to souls, you better find out what one is, because we pure flat do not know. We do not know. And you cannot, the time for being naively interested in, oh, isn't that so nice? We have computers, yada-dee-yada-dee. Isn't it funny that we're building communities on the net that are more vibrant and satisfying than our nuclear family? Isn't it cool that Johnny pulls out this phone and he texts all during supper because the people he's talking to mean more to him than his family because they really are his community? It's not that. It's a much more fundamental thing. Is we don't know. And it's not just Ray Kurzweil, and it's not just Nick Austin. It's scientist after scientist. It is Hameroff. It is Sir Roger Penrose, or it was, who are saying, watch out, and saying to the clergy, and because I'm in the business I am, I read a lot of the futurist conferences and their papers. one of the most fascinating of which didn't happen at a futurist conference. It happened 2 years ago at the Conference of International Trial Lawyers, in which one of the workshops was a mock trial, in which there was a good defense attorney and a good prosecuting attorney, and there was a jury and there was a seated judge, and we went through the whole business of the trial. And the trial had to do, and I can't remember her call number, so I'll call her Matilda. That wasn't her name. She had B2 somewhere or other. I don't remember. But anyway, Matilda was a huge mainframe computer that was owned by a company. And she had done, all the files were in Matilda. And she had done her job so well that the company was going to have to move to larger quarters. You heard it, yeah. And in order to do that, they were going to disassemble Matilda and reassemble her in new configurations. And when she heard that, when Matilda, this is a thing, okay? This is a machine. When the machine heard that, she went into her databanks and got out lawyers pro bono who would come and petition the court to understand that if she were reconfigured, she would no longer be Matilda, and therefore would be something else, and it was therefore murder to disassemble her. Now that sounds silly, doesn't it? Until you put it in context of trial lawyers in a meeting trying to decide what the law is going to do. It's near enough, what I'm telling you is, it's near enough so lawyers are preparing. At what point is the Matilda a thing, and at what point does she become a creature? What is the line at which murder happens as opposed to just disassembling? It was, for your information, a hung jury. I actually have the trial report. I printed it out. I was so fascinated by the line of argument. All very serious arguments about where that line is. So the truth of the matter is, as we begin to minister, we have to look not just at what information has happened, not just at what has, but we have to look at that. And then the last thing, and I will quit trying to be futuristic and talk about those things that I don't understand. understand enough to babble about them, though I cannot comprehend. And that is the fact that we are now in the information age. And when you hear that term bandied around, you think of it as passing facts back and forth. And that's not what a physicist means. What a physicist means, you take men like Bruce Bimber, who's not, by the way, on your bibliography, but Bimber is University of California at Santa Clara, I think, Santa Cruz, who's worried about accelerated pluralism. And accelerated pluralism happens when you've got so much information that people can mass over an issue instead of over natural bonding, and they're called smart crowds or flash crowds, one another, where they will come and assemble over an issue and then disappear and then reconfigure here and then reconfigure there and all of that. That's part of the information age. The rest of it is the fact that it now seems defensible physics that creation is made of energy, as we know, and that energy is also controlled by the other factor in creation, which is information, or coding, if you want to put it that way. That is to say that the coding, it determines what the energy does as it makes mass. Are you with me? At a simple level, at one I can almost understand, why in the world does one little cell, one tiny little cell, become us? What makes you out of one cell? What made you out of two cells? As we know, your daddy, when his sperm hit your mama's egg, it was one cell for a time. What made Bill out of that? And we all know the answer, DNA. What is DNA? A string of information. It is a string of coding. And it would now appear that it's information, in that sense, not in the swapping a bunch of facts, but it is the coding and the energy put together that make the mass. And that opens up a whole new world and a whole new way of understanding. Yeah.
If you're into sci-fi.
Oh, yeah, this isn't sci-fi.
This is thing got me on with the struggle that we're talking about right here has been a major theme.
Absolutely.
I mean, this weekend I finally got to go see the Terminator.
That's the theme of the whole movie. I still got to go see
what
it.
What makes them machine or human?
That's
What's the difference?
And we don't know. Yeah. And
that is
Pastor, oh, you better find out.
Yeah.
You know, because your people are going to, they're going to go see that movie. The most significant influential piece of theology published in the last half of the last century, and that's a pretty broad statement, was Matrix.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's infotainment, and it's theater entertainment. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And you're right. Sci-fi has been saying this for decades. It didn't take a genius to see it. Yeah. Now you've got scientists proving it. And so it's the world you work in. And part of emergence Christianity is it's willing to accept that world. Nothing annoys me more than having somebody tell me that emergence Christianity is just young folks. That is such bull. It is not young folk. It is primarily folk over 60 and under 45. I'll give you that. It's the age group in between that's squeezed. Because these are old enough to enjoy being dotty, and these grew up in emergence culture. And it's these who can't figure out what they're doing, you know, who are just miserable. And we'll speak of them tomorrow, because they have to be ministered to, too. But this is not a young person's phenomenon. This is, you know, this is here. And it really matters. One that I jumped that probably matters enormously is when television came, we changed, the rules completely changed. And remember some of you, Fulton Sheen, sweeping on to that, you know, I loved watching him. I could believe in Roman Catholicism just briefly as Bishop Fulton Sheen swept on in that cape and the cope, I think you would call it, and the crown and the staff, you know, and he proceeded to tell America how to be good. He was the first to understand the importance. And it went from there, obviously, to put your hand on the box and say a prayer, you know, and we'll pray for you, especially if you put $5 in the envelope before you put your hand up here. And we got the televangelist who so shamed mainstream Christianity. But what we also got was Joseph Campbell. And Joseph Campbell, who had been at Sarah Lawrence and had been a comparative religionist, was the first, he and Bill Moyers together, the great communicator, to understand what you could do with television that you wouldn't dare do in any other venue. Campbell died before the Power of Myth showed for the first time in 1989, died just shortly before that, so it's posthumous. But the Power of Myth is still the bestseller every single year and has been since 89, the bestseller in PBS's films. It always sells more. And why does it matter? It matters because it assumes that all gods are more or less the same, that all religions are more or less the same, that they all more or less go to the top of that mountain or they hit the same elephant. And he proves it academically. He proves it intellectually. If he had stood in a pulpit and made that pronouncement, he would have been booed out, carried out, and maybe burned. The power of television is the fact that the word comes in while you're sitting in a lounge chair at home, in your comfies or in your jeans or something, and you may even have a beer or two, and you're totally relaxed, and all the bars are down, and it just comes in, and don't you know, it's entertainment, and it doesn't matter. And the first thing you know, it's there. And part of the theology of religion question comes in directly through Joseph Campbell, whether he meant for it to or not, I don't know, it's immaterial. He succeeded, and from there you see it. Okay, now we have an 8-minute break, which probably will go to 10 or 15.